explore the people, stories, and events in our 7-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Susan Franson, taking a road trip to Cambridge with Jonah Powell later in the program. But before we get started, we have Leanne Harder here in the studio with us for her monthly Story County Report. Hi, Leanne.
Good morning.
What can we look forward to in Story County in January?
Well, let me start by saying Happy New Year. It's already 2018. Work sessions for the Story County Board of Supervisors are kicking off. Now that we're in January, we're going to look at what's going to be happening in fiscal year 19. So our fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th annually. So we're looking ahead basically what the county will be needing for expenses and revenues starting in July. All those work sessions are with department heads and elected officials. They're all open to the public, and so we encourage the public to attend. If you can attend in person, they are taped, audio taped, and so you can listen back in after the meeting's done. It's an opportunity to stay informed and see what the county officials are doing with taxpayers' money. You can go to the county's website, which is www.storycountyiowa.gov, and there's a link there for budgets. Then a pretty exciting time. Since we have the new year, we want to celebrate what happened in 2017. It was a great year for Story County. So we do that by compiling our annual report. Yesterday, the Board of Supervisors approved the annual report, so we'll have that out. And it'll be available online at the website I just mentioned, but it'll be at all county libraries and city halls starting in a couple weeks once we get everything printed. But that's a fun report to put together just to look at the snapshot of what occurred last year. If I remember right, the Board of Supervisors acted on nearly 1,100 items. That's everything just from approving requests for proposals to big items, amending regulations, and whatever you might have. So the board was really active in 2017. Some news from Story County Conservation. Story County Conservation does invite everyone to go to attend Wild Tots. Well, not everyone. You have to be a tot and a parent. But they have a program called Wild Tots Winter Wonders. It will be held at McFarland Park on Saturday, February 3rd, so coming up. And it's an opportunity to get that tot out of the house because he or she might be driving you nuts inside and explore the wonders of winter through a series of activities, crafts, and a snack. It's for children ages 2 to 4, plus the adult accompanying them. Registration and fee per child is required by 4:30 Wednesday, January 31st. Be prepared to play outside and indoors. But it's an opportunity to get them outdoors. And there's a website that you can go to mycountyparks.com to register, and I'll get you the link, too, so you can put it online.
And I'd like to put in a word for pre-registering early, because there were a couple of really neat snowshoe events that were coming up, and when I checked about them, they were all booked already.
That is a great point. I mean, I know I've firsthand experienced our conservation programs, whether it be at the school or through activities at McFarland Park. They do book out early. They're reasonably priced, so that is attractive for a lot of different types of people. It's an opportunity to get your hands on things that you never really thought you'd be involved in. And the staff up there is just incredible. They just are amazing individuals, and they're so dedicated to conservation and spreading the message. So with that, I do want to kind of switch gears a little bit to the Environmental Health Department. They actually, throughout the month of January, so only a couple more weeks left, they have 50 radon test kits available at no charge. And so just contact the Environmental Health Department, and they're on our website as well. You can go through www.storycountyiowa.gov, click on departments, and then look for Environmental Health, and their contact information is there. But I'm sure everyone has seen the public service announcements on TV about radon and its presence in Iowa, and this opportunity to get a kit and see if it's present in your house or not. And then Veterans Affairs, a message from Brett McLean, our Veterans Affairs director. He did want to invite everyone to join the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs and the Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs for the 2018 Veterans Day at the Capitol on Wednesday, January 17th. So that's actually a week from today. On the first floor of the Capitol Rotunda, beginning at 9 a.m., There will be an opportunity to visit several vendor tables with veteran information, and then a program begins at 10 a.m. It's also a chance for veterans to meet with local elected officials following the program and during the time discussing the legislative initiatives there before our lawmakers in Des Moines.
Is this like a Veterans Lobby Day?
It sounds like it, yeah. Yeah. An opportunity for veterans, though, to get out and see. This might be the chance a veteran might be able to see the benefits that he or she deserves and may not be aware of it. And they happen to be visiting the Capitol for something or another and an opportunity to get in contact with the system. Then we are in tandem with our budget. We're starting to look at our draft capital improvements plan. That's our plan we have to guide us in the multi-year in construction and improvement of county facilities and acquisition of equipment. That goes part and parcel with the budget. So at the point we are right now, we're asking for input. Starting Tuesday, January 16th, the plan will be available online, and we'll also send it to city halls and libraries. It'll have a comment sheet. It'll look through fiscal year 2022. That's difficult to say, but it's an opportunity to look 5 years in the future, make sure we're doing orderly maintenance of our physical assets, planning ahead and structuring a meaningful long-range perspective of our capital needs, and using it to acquire, develop, construct, renovate our public facilities, again, making sure we're cognizant of taxpayer funds. So we invite comment on that. That will actually be approved in March at the same time the budget's approved. And so when I come back in February, I'll share those dates. Now, switching gears one more time, voting is now available in the Story County Auditor's Office for the February 6th Roland Story Community School District special election. You can go in person and do absentee voting for the special bond election in the auditor's office now. You'll see signs around the building to direct voters. The building's located at 906th Street in Nevada. It's the administration building where you go to get your taxes or pay your taxes, get your vehicle tags, all those types of services.
Is that the old city hall? The old county courthouse.
Yeah, old county courthouse. That's how I still call it. Any resident of the Roland Story Community School District can cast a ballot during regular office hours. Those are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And if you want to see a sample ballot before you vote, it's right outside their office. If you have any questions about voter registration, absentee ballots, polling places, et cetera, for your family members or you, especially if you have someone in the military, away for college, or in long-term care at the hospital, always contact the county auditor's office. I know I have a daughter that recently turned 18. I was very pleased to see her voter registration card come in the mail, and I know they were able to answer lots of questions that we've had along the way. So all the county facilities and information about Story County is on our website. I've said it two times. I'll say it a third time. It's www.storycountyiowa.gov. And as always, if you have any questions or concerns, you can contact me directly at 515-382-7247.
Well, thank you. And incidentally, anybody who goes to our website, also every time you come, we have that website up on ours.
And I appreciate that because I've actually had a couple of people that's how they heard something and then they remembered, oh, I don't remember what the website is, but I'll go to KHOI and find it. And so it's been a great tool. And I appreciate being able to come here monthly and visit with you and look forward to 2018.
So do we.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Leanne.
Have a good day.
You too. In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to our monthly report from Story County Outreach and Special Projects Manager Leanne Harter. Those of you who listened to our show on January 3rd know that one of the upcoming events then was the Metropolitan Opera auditions on January 6th at Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall. One of last year's winners, Chad Sonka, told us about the experience from the participants' perspective. After hearing what he had to say, I was eager to attend the auditions, even though I had never attended one of these annual events since I've been in Ames, and I was unprepared for what a remarkable experience it would be. Each soloist was to bring a character from the opera to the stage by singing an aria without benefit of costumes or sets. So they were acting as well as singing. That was something that Chad said, but until I saw it, I didn't realize what a different experience this would be from going to a regular concert, because they were sometimes walking around the stage, agitated. One even ended with a salute, which was what his aria demanded. And they were also supposed to prepare pieces in two languages in addition to English. And so all of the 24 participants, that's four more than last year, had a list of five arias, and they sang their favorite aria, the one that they most wanted to show off first, and then the judges selected another from the four remaining. So, for example, once the judges said, sing the song in English, because most of them, in fact, all but Chad, sang their first selection in some other language, German, Italian, French. But Chad was late in the program, and I kept wondering, what's he going to do that'll stand out? Because the singers were really phenomenal to my ear, and I think to the ears of most of the audience, because this is another thing that was different about this. We had two intermissions because of the competition lasted from noon to 4:30. So we had a couple of breaks. And during the breaks, the participants, the singers, came out into the lobby and talked to people. Usually friends came up and talked to them because, of course, they had a lot of friends and family members there. So you got an idea of what other people were thinking, too, because the remarks over and over again are, my, it's going to be hard to judge this. There's so many good singers. Particularly, I heard a discussion about these two phenomenal tenors. So I wondered, how are they going to do this? And how is Chad going to stand out? Well, what he did was he sang an aria in English, and it's an opera that is in the repertoire since 1970. It's Of Mice and Men, which is well known as a novel. He sang George's aria, which was really the song of a desperate man talking about, there's got to be more to life than what I have. And it was very moving, beautifully sung. Every word was clear. And incidentally, when he sang the second song in German, it was equally clear. When the judges came back, he wasn't one of those chosen to go on to the next level. The winners, there were four this year since there were 24 entrants, and they were all women, two sopranos, one mezzo-soprano, and the only contralto who was among the singers. So I said I'd tell you how it went, and I just did. And now we need to move on to our road trip.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I am Jonah Powell, one of the co-hosts for KHOI's virtual road trip to Cambridge. Susan picked me up at my house on Meadow Glen Road.
And I'm so glad you can join me today, Jonah. I'll be driving my Prius and we'll rely on you for navigation. First, you'll take us to Highway 30. Is that right?
Yes, that's what Siri tells me. She always finds the fastest route.
Now that we're on Highway 30, is she going to take us to 35?
She'll skip the exit to 35, but we'll just wait and see where she tells us to turn. Oops, we missed the first one. Now we're approaching 580th Avenue with a big green sign that points right to Cambridge.
Well, at least it's a well-paved road with no traffic and no snow.
And it's a beautiful day. Sun on the snow in the fields, and it's pretty warm.
And it's not far. In no time at all, we'll be in Cambridge. My first interview is with Rhonda Senar, whose picture was on the front page of the Tri-County Times last week with the Lil Food Pantry in her front yard. The article was mostly about the bus stop breakfast that she and her team from the United Methodist Church in Cambridge started just last week.
I see the United Methodist Church. It's a big white frame building.
And I see the little food pantry. There's her house right behind it. I know she's expecting us. Hello, Rhonda. I'm Susan Franson from KHOI in Cambridge today, and I'm here with my co-host, Jonah Powell.
Hi, Rhonda.
I read about your bus stop breakfast, and I wanted to explore the story a little bit. Could you tell me who you are and how you got the idea?
Okay, well, I am a former youth leader at the Methodist Church in Cambridge. My husband and I live right across the street from the church, so we kind of see the comings and goings all the time. And recently, the bus was picking up kids a block south of our house and the church, and they had a complaint down there because the kids were fooling around, typical kid stuff. So they moved it a block north, right at the church corner. So when we saw this, we thought, you know, we know there's a lot of hungry kids in our community. As the youth leader, former youth leader, we had started helping provide food for our backpack buddy kids at Ballard. And so I shop weekly for those sacks that go home with the kids. So I knew there was many kids in Cambridge specifically that were hungry or of free and reduced lunches, low income, so and so on. So we just thought, what a great opportunity. We can, you know, make some quick breakfast, give it to the kids, and get them on the bus. So that's what we started doing. And it's been a little bit of fun, and we've kind of got it down to a system now. The church members help. We have a couple people that show up in the mornings on Wednesday. We typically, right now, we're just doing it one day a week. We have had requests for more days. The kids love cinnamon rolls. And they love we make these sausage corn dog things. They're dipped in pancake batter. So two easy things. We have milk and juice. And the kids like it. So with this cold weather, they've been able to come in the church basement and get warm or stay in there while they're waiting. And so it's just been a blast.
Well, it sounds really like a wonderful service. And I have a question because I know that you have kids from Cambridge that are being bused to the elementary school in Slater, as well as the junior and senior high school in Huxley. So, are they all on the same bus?
Yeah, there's two buses that come into town to pick kids up. They do swing out through the country and pick up a few kids. So I think there's around 7 or 8 kids approximately on both of the buses. So we typically have enough food that we can give the bus driver something and the kids that are on the bus as well. So that's been kind of fun, too. I think it surprised them.
Oh, it must be a nice surprise to get a breakfast like that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Now, I don't know how these free food programs work because I know that, of course, you don't want to stigmatize kids.
Right.
So does everybody get a bus stop breakfast?
Yeah, anybody who wants one can have one. In fact, there are a few parents who drive their kids there and wait. The kids will wait in the car, and we'll even take it to them and have given, you know, dads and their pickups as they're driving by a cinnamon roll. So kind of a drive-up service. But, yeah, anybody who wants one, and we don't pick and choose. Anybody is welcome.
Now, this is kind of an expansion of the Backpack Buddies program that I think you mentioned that you were shopping for that, right?
Right, yeah. When this first started, my youth kids said, let's do a food packaging event. You've probably heard of Meals from the Heartland, and there's another one over in central Iowa, farther east of Cambridge. I think it's called Outreach. And they do meal packaging events. And so we were going to do that, and it just wasn't being blessed. We just kept having all these stumbling blocks. So, you know, I'm a prayer, and I prayed to God to just show me what you want us to do. Well, then we found out about the kids getting these sacks going home every weekend, and we thought, well, what about buying fresh produce? So we started out buying fresh produce. And just this last few months, we've realized that the fresh produce wasn't being utilized like we wanted, and we felt like it was maybe a waste of our resources. The counselors at school were telling me that they were finding some of the fresh produce left in lockers, and I know for a fact that some of the parents don't know how to cook the fresh produce, and we would try to help them figure out, you know, how to cook sweet corn, for instance, or, you know, how to prepare these foods. It's really difficult. A lot of these kids are maybe home alone after school, and so they are kind of on their own at times. So we decided that we would be better using our money to buy prepackaged foods. It wasn't what I wanted, but I realized that we have limitations and the kids have to eat. So if they're cooking their own foods, they need, you know, microwavable meals or snack food that, like granola bars or Teddy Grahams or those sorts of things that they can help themselves to and not have to, you know, worry about mom or dad fixing it for them. So that kind of changed here in the last few months. So, but we're, you know, we're still trying to provide something every Friday to the kids.
And you have a food pantry also, I read in the paper.
Right. Our church, us and the Lutherans, have done a food pantry for very many years there. And so along with we put up the little free pantry that was also in the article. And that was also so that kids can just walk by and get something, or anybody really could drive by, pick up something if they needed it, and they don't have to go to the food pantry. Maybe there's such a stigma attached to that, and there's so much pride that, you know, people don't want to admit that they need help. So the little free pantry is wonderful too. We see it being used primarily by the kids, and they get either before they get on the bus, they'll go grab a granola bar, or maybe they'll grab some ramen noodles or whatever after school. And we've also had a couple of our folks from church put in hats and gloves, and so there's been kids that had to go grab a hat or a pair of gloves out also.
The picture in the Tri-County Times then looked like somebody was standing by a phone booth. Is that the little free pantry?
Yeah, that's me, and I was standing there in front of the free pantry, yes. It's actually in my yard, but we wanted it so the sun wouldn't beat into the pantry, so that's why we put it in our yard, so that the sun is kind of behind it, and, you know, just to kind of help keep the food a little bit, you know, not getting beat on it by the sun and so on.
So that's across the street from the church.
Yep.
This always reminds me of one of the first people I met from Cambridge, and that was Mike Mackey. And he said, the people in Cambridge care and take care of each other more than any place I've ever been.
And, Mike and I work together a lot on this, on the food and the snacks and stuff, since he's one of the counselors at the school, and him and I and the other counselors are very familiar with each other. I feel like I'm kind of a clearinghouse for food. I have many people that will call me and say, hey, I have a donation of this. And so I, you know, will meet with them, or they drop it on my porch, and then I get it to Mike or the other counselors. We've also been blessed to have people say, hey, I have a couch I want to donate, or I have dressers, or whatever it might be. And yeah, we do. We just really take care of our own in Cambridge. And I'm from a small town in northern Iowa, but that's what I love about living there. People watch out for each other.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. This is a beautiful, beautiful story.
Everybody's so willing to help or donate. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too.
Where are we going next?
At 3 o'clock, we have an appointment with Mayor Stephen Kovarik, who will show us around the newly built Cambridge City Center over on Water Street.
That'll give us a little time to look around the town. The houses are nice looking and well kept. And there's an old school that looks like it's been made into apartments.
Yes, and I know it has, because Ron Latson, who used to be a volunteer at KHOI, lived there as a single dad with two daughters, and he had the best things to say about Cambridge and how welcoming it was. And it's always nice to see an old school renovated as an apartment building. And one of the real attractions of Cambridge today is its recently built upper elementary school. It's on the west edge of town. Here's Water Street. I can park right across the street from the Cambridge City Center.
Let's try the door on the center and see if the city clerk has an appointment for us. Ah, the door is locked.
Uh-oh. But we still have 15 minutes. Let's look at the library. Last week, I had a phone interview with Janet Thorson, the librarian. I'd like to see what the old library looks like.
The sign says it closes at 2 p.m.
Oh, well, we can look in the windows. I can see why people are so excited about a new library. This one looks just as full of books as it can be. They have made room for a table in the front, though. I suppose that's where they have story times. It must be where they do crafts as well.
It looks wonderfully inviting. It's just like the library in the town where I was raised, in Phillipsburg, Montana. They can certainly use more space, though.
I think we'd better get over to the new Cambridge City Center. I think the man coming this way on the street must be the mayor. I'd better get everything set up for the interview. Well, I'm here with the new mayor of Cambridge, Stephen Cavari, in the new Cambridge City Center.
Normally our council meetings are held in the building. The library is also housed here. And then we've got a large hall area for events.
Are you going to take us on a tour?
Absolutely. So we just received a grant from Story County Community Foundation, which allowed us to purchase a few new computers. We've got a couple of them in already, but we'll be getting another one computer that'll be a Mac. These two are Windows, and then we'll also have a printer in here for people to use. We put wireless throughout the building, so the network is easily available. We've got it on a four-hour lease, so when people come in with their wireless devices, if they've got an iPad or an Android device, they can easily come in, connect to the Cambridge wireless, and it'll give them a four-hour lease on their IP. 4 hours is a good long time when you're sitting in a library, I think.
And I see you have some very nice places to sit and read.
Yeah, that's kind of we looked at it for a little bit more of the adult area. You know, when the adults are here, they bring kids in, the kids are doing their little event. The adults can sit off to the side and kind of read a book, or if they want to be on the internet, that works too.
I see the bookshelves have arrived, and it looks like you have room for all the books in the old library and room for more. Last week we talked with Janet Thorson about the move of the library and what they do. They have lots of children's story times. Will they be in this room?
Yes, they will be. Some of the events that could be a little bit more messy, you know, it involves glue or that kind of thing. We can always hold those out in the larger area that we've got just to make sure that, you know, it's carpeted in here. We don't want to have the carpet ruined right away, but try and find ways to accommodate everything.
I have heard really wonderful things about your new space. So
the idea here was to have kind of a space for community events, weddings, that kind of thing. So we've got space here for seating for 250 people. It has a full kitchen. The event center can be scheduled through the city clerk. And so she has all of the information about what the charges are for the room on a half day, full day, or a weekend basis. Again, back here, it's fully wireless available. We've got a projector in place if they were having an event that needed to display something onto projection screen. Full audio, so we've got wireless mics that are available if they're having a wedding and people are giving speeches. Everybody can hear them.
Well, it looks like you have a courtyard.
We do have a courtyard. So off of the main portion of the building here, we cemented between the new building and one of the current buildings. So we've got about 25 feet by the full depth of the building for people to gather outside. We also put in a little bit of a lift area here to where they could have a DJ outside if they wanted to, or if they wanted to have a DJ inside, if it were a wedding and they decided to do a party after the wedding. There's a couple of spaces that are available on the sides for the DJ to be able to do everything. They can hook into the speaker system here, or if they want to do their own speaker system, there should be enough power to do that too.
Well, it looks like you have a really big institutional-sized kitchen.
Absolutely. What we decided to do was, you know, if you're going to try and do an event center like this, you want to try and make sure that you have plenty of good working equipment. We've got a warming oven that kind of sits off to the back. We've got a full refrigerator that's racks inside. You can bring in anything you need. An industrial oven with full fire suppression associated with it. And then, as you can see, large sinks. The other thing that we did was we made sure that we had a nice big area with an overhead door, so you can easily bring things in through the overhead door. You can just pull a truck up, things can come in and easily get them into the building.
And that is that your furnace?
Yeah, that's the basically a little bit of storage back there, but it's fire alarm units back there, water heating. All of the heating for the building is actually up on the roof.
So what kind of heat system do you have?
It's a heat pump unit, so highly energy efficient. The idea was to make sure the building was efficient as possible.
How did this funding come about? It was a couple years in the making, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a couple years in the making. Scott DeYoung, who was the mayor before me, and the council decided that it was important to try and find a way to incorporate a new city building. We had a smaller area for community events that was part of the fire station, and the fire station needed to expand. So what we did was we allowed them to take over the portion that was the community center, along with a little addition that they did for the fire trucks, and then we took on the building of this building. A little bit of funding from a lot of different directions. We used some TIF funding for the building, and a lot of private donations.
Did you have a bond issue?
We did not bond. We did not go out for a bond issue, so this is all funded. Should be paid off in about 8 years' time.
What's the population of Cambridge?
850.
Pretty nice building for 850.
Very nice building for 850. We had an event just before Christmas, and I think we had 300 and some people that came through. Just a very nice event. Had Santa Claus here, so kids got to see Santa Claus, and we had some food and just let people come in and take a look at the building and see what it looked like, and had information about what the costs were for rentals. So a lot of paper went out so that people could see what the costs were. But we've already got some events scheduled, a couple of weddings already. So anybody looking for an event center, feel free to give the City Hall a call or an email, and we'll go from there.
I saw your little video on your Facebook page, very nice video, and someone in there said that he thought that this building would lead to community development, that it would attract business or people wanting to move to Cambridge. Do you have any idea about that?
We do have some development plans that we would like to move forward with. We have kind of an industrial park area that we've been working with a few businesses to expand down there. We've got a couple of businesses in town that are, or buildings in town that could take on a few businesses. And then we're also looking to do some housing. So we figure we can put on about 75 more houses with people in them without causing too much stress on the infrastructure that we have. We've done a lot of work over the last several years. New water tower. We did renovations to the pumping and filtration system, some work on both storm sewer and water to the houses. So the main water infrastructure, the water mains, is all in pretty good shape.
And with your expanded fire department, raising a lot of money for your fire department, because I keep seeing the fundraisers. For example, what used to be your Skunk River Valley days, you have now, it's Fireman's Days.
Correct.
And I kind of wondered, what are the plans for the fire department?
Well, the fire department has a territory that they're responsible for taking care of. There's a little overlap, like we overlap partially with Huxley, partially with Nevada. So there's some areas that we overlap in. Just in case there's a really big fire, we can go into the other districts and help out. But we're not looking at expanding the territory. What we're really looking at is just making sure that we've got a good building with all the equipment inside, make sure that it's in a good, safe environment, and just kind of free up a little bit more space, because they were really kind of compacted in just a two-stall area. And so putting addition onto the back of the building really helps with that. The fire safety is always a big issue, so we wanted to make sure that we were able to keep fire safety here in the town.
Sounds like Cambridge is really, well, should I say better?
I think it's growing. I think, we've brought some houses in over the last, 15, 20 years. So we've got a bigger population than we had 20 years ago, which is an important thing. You want to grow the town, but you don't want to just grow the town in a flash. You want to have a slow growth, so you can continue doing things in a more meaningful manner, rather than some towns you see will grow very fast. I know Ankeny has grown just immensely. It takes a lot of money to be able to do that, and with a small population, we don't want our taxes to get too crazy out of hand. So the idea is to keep the taxes low on our per capita. So if you keep the taxes low, it allows people to come in a little bit easier.
Well, thank you.
You bet.
And it's not part of this story, but you have a delightful school.
Oh, yeah. The Huxley Ballard School is a wonderful school district.
Yes.
very innovative. They've done a nice job with the buildings, and I think overall they've been a good addition.
Thank you.
You bet.
We've got a companion story to this that's about something that the first time we came down, we talked to Scott DeYoung and Mike Mackey.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Mackey said then something he repeated to me when I went to the school, that he has never been to a place where they cared so much about the people.
Yep. That is the whole idea. The community center, the community city center that we've got here is really about the people. It's not about anything else other than making sure that the people have a place to gather and have, good conversations. Library is a really good addition to that, so, people could easily come in and just sit and relax and have a conversation.
Thank you.
You bet.
That city center really makes a big difference in the Cambridge downtown.
Though it's clear that not all the storefronts are occupied, it has some impressive buildings. All the old buildings on both sides of the street are either brick or brownstone. It has a really inviting-looking antique shop, and the Water Street Grill has been replaced by the Tattered Toad. It got a 5-star review on Facebook.
Really? What did it say?
Great local spot. The big screen is great for sporting events. The cheese balls and tenderloin we ordered were delicious, and the drinks are refreshing. They have a good-sized patio out back with tables also. The events they put on are great, and proceeds go to local charities. Way to give back to the community, guys.
But they're too small to have a newspaper.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we have a great sequel to last week's interview with Marla Sparker, editor of both the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times. Ed Rude, who was editor of the Tri-County Times before Marla's, published an article last week about the 125th anniversary of that paper and the ones that went before it. I'm here in the studio with Ed Rude of Cambridge, who was the author of a recent article on the 125th anniversary of the Tri-County Times. By the article, there's a photograph of some people standing by an old linotype machine. Ed, why don't you describe this picture?
Okay, the picture was taken back in, 1940, and it's in the back shop of the Slater News. And it shows my parents and a shoe cobbler by the name of Walter Lee. It also shows me at the ripe age of 1 year of age. And I was evidently just probably there when the photographer came in to take the picture. And so I was included in it. And the we're standing there actually on the behind what they call the stone, which is what they used to build pages on back in the old letterpress days.
And you actually grew up with that equipment.
I did. I started running a linotype when I was like 12 years of age, and it was a dangerous piece of equipment. And my father, it took him that long to trust me to actually sit down and try to run it. And the other parts of it, the hand type and things like that, I did as a younger age. But it was 12 before he trusted me with the linotype.
Of course, that is only the technical part of the newspaper business. And our interview with Marlis Barker last week was about the magic of small-town newspapers. And I imagine that you have a great feeling for that kind of magic and how it's changed over the years.
Yes. Years ago, the Small Town Weekly was basically information for the local town. It featured births, weddings, deaths, and it was kind of the history of the town as it grew and or as it dwindled, as the case might be. But anyway, the newspapers slowly became larger because they had to survive, and that's what's happened. And now a lot of the newspapers share news and share photos and information to help each other out and to also meet more people so more people can read and find out what's actually taking place in the area. The schools have a lot to do with that because a lot of the people in these small towns are connected by the schools. Not only do their children attend those schools, they also attend a lot of the events that these schools present, and they like to see what's going on in other towns, and so that's what's made it a different type of information, but yet building on greater readership.
The kind of things that you feature must have changed over the years.
Oh, yes. It used to be quite a bit of the news was someone had dinner at someone's place or someone went over to someone's place to help maybe make Christmas dinner or something, and this was featured. This was the big features in those little newspapers back in those days. It was more what a lot of people call gossip news.
The society news, the particularly weddings, where they describe the wedding dresses and in some cases, I guess, even wedding presents. I don't know whether that was done as recently as 1939.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. The weddings and engagements dominated the news along with, unfortunately, the obituaries. But some of the wedding stories would run 20, 24, 25 inches long, and they would include a complete description of what the bride wore, what the bride's mother wore, what her attendees wore, and what the groom and all his attendees wore. It would even go on to describe what they were going to do for their honeymoon, et cetera.
But that has changed.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
You mentioned earlier the importance of the papers as a historical record of the communities, the kind of things that were built and what people were doing. Now that some of these papers, the early papers, were not all together like the current Tri-County Times. In fact, was it the Tri-County Times when your parents bought it in 1939?
No, it was Slater News. And then back in the early 70s, before I bought the paper, they purchased the Cambridge paper and combined it. And then when I bought the paper, my wife and I in 1972, we later that year purchased the Maxwell paper and combined that and named it the Tri-County Times as we were serving Boone, Polk, and Story counties. I should say that in 1997, when I sold the paper, Sharon and I sold the paper, I continued to work for the Ames Tribune until 2003. And there I served as the editor and worked basically writing as well. And I got into more writing that way because back before that, I didn't have the time to write more than a story or two a week because we were so busy on other things. And then I finally got more into it, and then I started doing quite a bit of writing for the Ames Tribune, too, at the time. And then I started a nature photo that ran weekly for 20 years in the Ames Tribune. And then I also did my column and still do my column. And it appears weekly in the Tri-County Times and, like you say, other newspapers as well. And basically I learned from my writing that it's a lot of work, too. I didn't realize how much work a lot of my reporters were doing to substantiate their stories. And I hate to say it, but I think there's much less time put in substantiating stories today than there were back even 5-10 years ago. We used to make sure we had the facts before we published.
In speaking to a former editor of the Ames Tribune, what he said was that they keep cutting the staff and cutting the staff hours, and that there were stories they couldn't cover because the staff had already filled up their 40 hours that week.
Exactly, exactly. Like the reporter that does the sports in the Tri-County Times also does it for the Nevada Journal. And he, I don't know how he can cover all those ball games because he's covering basically probably five high schools. They're athletics.
But that is very important for the newspapers.
We found that out soon after I become our editor, is that we kind of did a little survey, and that was by far our biggest response was high school sports. That's what they wanted more than basically any other news item. And so that's what we geared ourselves to was high school sports. Always had a sports editor, or at least one, and maybe two or three writers. I was still editor. Originally, it went, the group that bought me went by Partnership Press, I believe was its name. And then not too long after that, it was sold to the Omaha World Herald. And the Omaha World Herald owned it when I relinquished my editorship and retired.
Yes, I guess it's really fairly recently that the Stevens Media took it, and then quite recently the Gateway.
Yes. Before we sold to the Partnership Press, I think there had been basically just four owners. It would have been, what, 70-some years. And so things changed a lot after that. Dad and Mom published it from 1939 to 1972, and I did from 72 until 97, basically, were publishers. And then it's changed hands several times since then.
But to get back to your work, you mentioned that you knew Pat Schlarbaum, and you also mentioned your nature photography. So you must have a pretty strong connection to people like Pat or Steve Lekwa or the other people who are very interested in nature in our area.
Yeah, I'd like to work with the DNR. Pat, of course, is just an unbelievable source of information. I've never stumped him, I don't think, on any question I've ever asked him. And Steve Lekwa, he was Story County Conservation Director, and he was a big ally of mine for years and years. And I've worked with various DNR people. And then, of course, Bill Herrine from Nevada was a very good friend of mine, and I worked with him a lot. And then Roger Hill and I were very close friends and did a lot of photography together. And I just have so many friends in the DNR and the Story County and Boone County Conservation. Really great people. I haven't ever had any problem with any of them.
You must have, if you're concerned with nature, had some causes that you wanted to promote in the paper.
Oh, we tried to. We always tried to promote conservation. We tried to promote clean water. From day one, I featured pictures showing erosion and other problems that were causing water problems. And we tried to always bring out litter, showing places where people were littering, and did a lot of editorials on trying to conquer such activities or get people to think twice before they committed such things. So, yes, we worked a lot on nature. That was a big part of our newspaper. And if someone noticed something, and I have I have to admit that my farmers and the whole area we covered were great allies in calling me when they saw things that were problems. And I had very good interactions with the farmers. I never had farmers ever turn me away from anything. And they always tried to promote, I thought, conservation in every way. And I have nothing bad to really say about my cooperation from the agricultural side of things.
What is the thing you miss the most about not being as involved with the newspaper business?
Oh, the people. You know, in my office, it was just an endless line of people would come in and to talk to me. I look forward to every day because I was going to meet somebody with a problem or with an idea or with a project that they wanted us to work on. And I loved working with people like that. And I had very good superintendents, very good principals, very good coaches that were always stopping by and giving me ideas, and we'd talk one-on-one and have a great time. And I don't know how much of that, I imagine a lot of that still continues, but that was the plus side of my life.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Ed.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
As we say goodbye to Ed Rude, KHOI ends its road trip to Cambridge. And I'd like to just take a minute to thank Ed for mentioning Pat Schlarbaum and Bill Harreen and Roger Hill, because Pat's certainly a regular contributor to KHOI, and he brought us tributes to Bill Harreen and to Roger Hill. So we're on the same page. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Susan Franzen, together with my road trip co-host, Jonah Powell. Thank you for listening. Other voices you heard were Leanne Harder, Rhonda Senar, Stephen Kovarik, and Ed Rude. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember that you can also hear us online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Misfortune.